Against the Grain Radio Show with your host, Nona Sam, live now.
Well, hello everybody. It's been a while. It's been crazy on my end. And it's got, oh Lord, I've got a couple more months left. A couple more months left of the craziness, and then it'll all be good. No complaints, though. No complaints. So here we go. Starting off today, I'll just talk a little bit about the stuff I've been doing on the homestead, and then we will get into the next section. I'll be reading chapter 3 for you from None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen. This is a book I strongly recommend that people read. I'm going to post a link here from 2 seconds for you guys. None Dare Call It Conspiracy. There we go. That link should work for you guys. So, cause the one that I used to use is no longer available, but that one should work. In the show notes, you guys can check that out, or if you want to, you can just pop over and find it yourself. Okay. So, this last little while has just been a little bit nuts for me. A whole bunch of things have happened. We have got a garden that we're trying to grow to hold us over for the winter for as much as the groceries as we can get so we don't have to buy as much stuff, but that has been a challenge and it has its successes. We've gotten a couple calves this year. That has been a challenge, but it's had its successes so far. We've been hatching chicken eggs this year, and again, challenge and successes so far, and today I'm getting a goat, a milking goat. So that should be interesting. I've been pounding my brain with what to do's and what not to do's, in particular the what not to do's, so I don't, you know, end up doing something stupid and killing the poor thing. So that's been good. It's been absolutely good. It's been, our summer has been very interesting here on the prairies. The whole month of June, I think we got 4 rains. It rained about once a week. And one of those 4 rains at our place here was nothing more than a sprinkle to get the ground wet to kind of settle the dust. It wasn't an actual rain, to put it quite nicely. So this year I got the idea that we're going to mulch the garden. We have a whole bunch of straw bales in the shed that we have there when we got our place. For you know, all intents and purposes with glorified rent, mortgages, blah, 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 got that place. They were using straw bale to put around the house, trying to keep some of the heat into the house. But the bales started falling apart. They started getting old. Wasn't really working anymore. I think we did that for 2 years, and it just wasn't working anymore. So this year we decided to put it in the garden because they were starting to, the strings were falling apart. So we put it in the garden this year. And I'll tell you what. They say that it saves, you know, up to 40% water. Holy smokes. Like, that saved a lot of our garden beginning of the year. So for folks that don't know, or folks that actually live in places where you can actually grow something where it's not, you know, wintertime half the year, and then like spring and fall for, you know, half of that half, and then you get 3 months of growing season here. So yes, we only get 3 months of growing season, June, July, August, and after that, I mean, if you've got a row cover, you can extend that a little bit depending on the size of your garden, or, I mean, if you've got a lot of money. You know, row covers, strongly recommended. I was actually talking to some farmer market folks that have the most beautiful vegetables, absolutely amazing vegetables. And yes, that's what they use, row cover, and they can extend their season there about 3 weeks. In springtime and more into the fall, particularly with things like, you know, tomatoes, they'll just keep producing, but you got to keep it warm. So, yes, mulching was an absolutely brilliant idea. Unfortunately, it did not keep the weeds down in my garden very well whatsoever. It's been turning into a forest. So on one hand, that's been really frustrating because it's kind of snuffing out the vegetables. But on the other hand, it's also been keeping a lot of the moisture in the ground too, because I noticed the areas that don't have very many weeds at all tend to dry up a little faster than the areas that do. The areas that do, it's still wet, like days after, even though the areas that have no weeds are bone dry right away. So I thought that was really interesting. And another thing, if you're going to use straw bale, because I was reading this book called Mulch It. I'll see if I can find it here really quick for you guys. Mulch It. We'll see if I can find it. Mulch It by Stu Campbell. It's a pretty good little informational book. It's got a bunch of different kinds of things with mulch and how you can use mulch in, like, wetter areas and not-so-wet areas and, you know, what mulches are, you know, everything from rocks to plastic to wood chips to, and there's so much information in this good little book, Mulch It, A Practical Guide of Using Mulch in the Garden and Landscape by Stu Campbell. If you guys are interested in this kind of stuff, pick that book up. It's a really good little book. But when they said that when you're going to do straw bale, that you need to add some extra nitrogen, they weren't kidding when they say you need to add some extra nitrogen. My garden was sprouting really well, and then to grow, everything is so stunted right now, and everything turned kind of an ugly yellow. It wasn't very good. I was looking at possibly not having a garden at all this year. So my mom found a bag of nitrogen at Early's, and she picked that up, and we put some of that in, mulched in or tilled in some of the straw. I'm currently putting new straw down, and then this fall, I'll talk about that in a second. But anyway, tilled in some of the nitrogen, and then it did happen to rain right around when we were doing that, and everything turned a beautiful green. We put two hits of nitrogen down on the garden just because we felt like we needed it, and everything is growing beautifully now. Everything has turned kind of a deeper, darker green. It's quite nice now. So if you're going to be mulching your garden, especially with straw bale, strongly recommend you get some nitrogen in that soil. Strongly recommend. In fact, you can't not put extra nitrogen in the soil, at least until the straw bale breaks down. I started watching, I think it's called Back to Eden. Give me a second here. Back to Eden. Gardening method, yeah. Back to Eden. Started watching that. Very interesting documentary so far. Apparently it's available on YouTube. Interesting. I'll throw that link up for you guys too. If you watch it and you enjoy them, you guys can pop over to their website and get their DVD, get their book. If you know, as you enjoy things, make sure you support the people who put them out. Because they do these things out of their passion, they care, they want people to know these things. So throw a little extra money their way. Throw a little extra money their way. If you enjoy what they do, throw some money their way to say, hey, you know, good work. Good work, because you would do that, you know, you would do that when you go buy your groceries, you would do that when, you know, you pay for your doctor, when you put gas in your car. I mean, just so help a brother out and throw some money their way. Back to you. Oh, what is going on? Perfect. I'll throw that up for you guys right now. Otherwise, I will forget it because it's that kind of a day. Oop. Cool. There you go. Show notes. We have Non-Dare Call and Conspiracy and Back to Eden documentary. Anyway, I will say that I did notice when I first started mulching my garden, wow, the amount of worms that I had in my garden. Wow, like, I was shocked. Last few years, like, I've had some worms, you know, you, every time you go digging in the garden, you pull up, you know, a worm here or there. But when I started mulching that garden, like, every shovel full probably had, like, 5 to 6 worms in a shovel. Like, I mean, there was some points where I would just dig down with my hand about, you know, 2-3 inches, and there was just worms galore. So many worms. Absolutely amazing how much life has come into that soil. There's, like, little mealworms. There was little mealworm things in there that I've never seen before. I don't know if that's because of straw bale or what. In particular, there was beetles, spiders, like, wow, like, I don't know if cutworms are bad or not. I'm sure somebody's going to tell me cutworms are bad, but I found a bunch of them in my garden. They don't seem to be doing too much damage to my garden so far. Everything seems to be growing fairly well, and I'm sure they've got enough, you know, weeds that they can go and destroy, too. But, like, my potatoes right now, Christ, they're, like, up to my waist. My peas are doing amazing. Carrots, not so much, but I let the weeds kind of overtake them a little bit. Tomatoes are doing amazing. My zucchinis are doing quite well. My cucumbers, not so much. Beans, not so much, but my dill is just gone wild. Squash are finally starting to catch up. Some of these things I might even just dig up and bring in and start gardening indoors rather than starting new. Because I want to do some gardening indoors over the winter, including doing sprouting for my animals. Especially our goat that we're going to be getting. And I'd really like to start doing some sprouting indoors, too, for the boys. Salt and Pepper are our steers there. So we got some plans for them boys. Going to keep one, going to put another one on the table. We'll figure it out. I know I sound a little heartless when I say that, but trust me when I say I don't say that very easily. I like to eat, but I sure as hell don't like the process of, you know, putting things on the table. It's just, it sucks. But, yeah, that's been really, really interesting so far. This whole gardening process, because it's like, oh, snap. Oh, I see your garden, Will. I just popped over to the Facebook to see if somebody was checking it out, but that is awesome. Well, and my friend, a whole bunch of people this year, I'm so excited they've all started gardening this year. Just a couple small plants. And I cannot begin to tell you guys how incredibly happy that makes me to see people even growing a tomato plant in a pot, like a planter. Like, just to start, you know, growing your own plants, growing your own food. It's so incredibly important that we need to start learning how to grow our own food and stuff right now, because if you pay attention to anything at all, hell, even if you're a mainstream news junkie, you're going to be seeing in the news, you have been seeing in the news, that we have been having quite interesting weather phenomenon that is completely destroying our current way of life. The commercialization of food, of animals, of, like, you know, life itself, with that kind of fun stuff. Oh, I hear my dad outside. Cool. I'm going to close this. I don't want people creeping. Here we go. Interesting. There we go. Anyway. Funny, I'm on a radio show and I don't want people listening to me today. Just kidding. Where was I? Yes, people growing gardens because our way of life is changing and it's not changing. I mean, I guess you could say in some aspects it's changing for the positive, but in many aspects it's changing quite for the negative. Positively, if, you know, you actually give a shit about the planet and you give a shit about other beings and, like, truly care about other beings, and if you've got, you know, if you're building community, if, you know, you're walking in step with, you know, Mother Earth and Creator, and, you know, or do whatever, I mean, if by whatever means you call you know, the forces external to yourself. If you're starting to be a little bit more on that spiritual side and, you know, understanding your greater purpose and that kind of stuff. So in that aspect, it's really awesome. Because we're kind of making that shift, and then we're kind of being humbled to realize that, like, we're not as powerful as we really think we are. And it's kind of bringing things back to the earth. Like, it's bringing things back to the way things kind of should be. But then on the other hand, your 9-to-5 work style, work lifestyle, you know, going to your office, coming home, going to the bar on weekends, watching the Netflix, going out with your friends, you know, not really giving a shit and just kind of moving through life to work the grind and then die. That's starting to slowly, well, actually it's going quite quickly with the grand solar minimum. It's starting to go pretty fast here. So with food and the way things are going with food prices, I mean, we've got a hay shortage right now, and it's not looking too pretty, folks. You can type in hay shortage 2019, and there are multiple articles talking about how the hay shortage is, it was bad last year. It was, you could talk to any local farmer, and it was bad last year. It's going to be even worse this year, because even around here, because the rain was so late, and then we got so much, but it still wasn't enough to help catch up with the drought that we had had for literally a whole month. It's going to start getting pretty scary here right away. Food prices are going up with the flooding that has happened down in the States. It's taking out whole crops. I mean, some people aren't even growing this year because they tried to start. And then with the flooding the way it was, I have friends down in South saying, like, or you can even see pictures. If you actually go and look, you can see pictures that, like, corn should be, like, head height by now, you know, like, growing up to the arms. And right now, it's only a foot tall. I mean, whoa. I mean, I don't know you guys, but, like, that's kind of crazy. Ever so slightly, because, I mean, how much corn is in everything that we eat? I mean, high fructose corn syrup, how much of that, you know, corn sweeteners is in everything that we eat? And that's just corn. And we're not talking about hay for animals or any kind of other crops like, you know, wheat or anything else. That's just the corn. One of the U.S.'s main exports there in that area. So things are going to start looking pretty ugly on a global scale. With this grand solar minimum and stuff going on. So, I really hope that any of my listeners out there really take the time to even just start. Just start working on a homestead. Just start. If you're living in an apartment, you know, I get it. You have tight space. You've got tight schedules, that kind of stuff. But, like, throw a planter up in the window. You know, window gardening is huge. Oh. Well then. Huh, that's funny. I've been building myself a milking stand. And apparently a saw that I used, I was trying to cut this piece of this milking stand off, was used, it's for metal and plastic, not for wood. My journeyman carpenter husband is laughing so hard at me right now. Anytime I'm trying to do any sort of building, he just laughs at me. Because, like, he'll just come over and he's like, okay, just let me do it. I'm like, no, I'm going to do it. And he's just like, just let me do it. This hurts to watch. It would be like me watching him try and crochet, like, a toque or something. And I'd just be sitting there, like, beating my head into the wall trying to watch his stuff. But, yes. Here's a little interesting article that I found here. Floods in Midwest, will you pay more for food after extreme weather? And this is from March 29, 2019, from USA Today. The bomb cyclone and flooding that damaged a huge section of U.S. Midwest farmland in March could cost you at the grocery store. Not could, guys. I'm telling you right now, just like from even being up north and watching the grocery prices up north start skyrocketing, it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad. Beef prices at supermarkets could rise 25 to 50 cents per pound, and pork as much as a dollar, estimates Phil Flynn, a senior market analyst at Price Futures Group in Chicago. Let's scroll down here. Oh, don't tell me I have to do a survey. Rude. Interesting. But anyway, I'm not doing that survey. To hell with it. Go to hell, USA Today. It didn't have to tell me to do a survey before, and now it's saying I gotta do it. Rude. This one says I gotta do it too. What is up with these news sites and wanting you to do surveys to read their news? What silly shit. Interesting. I had like 5 articles up, and now they all just popped up with these surveys. Oh, yes, and then when they brought in the federal carbon tax, that's expected to increase shipping costs of hay, further raising prices. So not only do we have a shortage here in Canada, I mean, it was a shortage because we didn't get enough rain. Unlike the States, a lot of places here didn't get enough rain, so it's late. And now we're going to be doing this carbon tax crap on top of it. And it's going to make everything, like, much, much more expensive. Here, I'll read this article to you guys. The producer, this one is from www.theproducer.com. It's called The Western Producer. So, hay prices skyrocket as drought continues. And this is from May 23rd, 2019. So, it's only a couple months ago. Abnormally dry conditions have been reported from Edmonton to Winnipeg, as well as scattered pockets of drought. Winnipeg, hay prices have continued to skyrocket across the prairies as conditions remain dry enough that many hay growers won't produce the first cutting this spring. We've had a tough start here, said Darren Chapman, chair of Manitoba Forage and Grassland Association. We had a cold, dry spring with frost, so first cut in the pastures had a slow start. First cut will be ready later, and it's possible the hay will mature quicker, so we'll have a lower yield. Yes. True story, we were still getting, like, frost in, like, the first, second week of June. Like, usually we plant May long weekend because you might have, you know, about a bit of frost, but not as bad as we had this year. There was, like, 3 days where it got to, like, -3 or -4. I think the one day was even down to -5. Like, it was insane. And that was, like, what, first or second week of June? It was a little out of the ordinary for us, not even lying. So it kind of screwed up a whole bunch of stuff. There was a bunch of folks, especially down south, closer to Regina and area, where it's actually, you know, like a few degrees warmer than up here. They had all their tomatoes planted. I think I cracked open Facebook the one day, and this woman had, like, 100 tomato plants planted, and she, like, lost all of them. All of them. They all died because of the frost. We've had a tough start. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, continuing. We had a cold, dry, blah, blah, blah. Okay, where am I? Okay, as of April 30th, Canada's Drought Monitor reported abnormally dry conditions stretching from Edmonton and Winnipeg, with pockets of moderate to severe drought conditions located across the prairies near Swan River, Yorkton, Saskatoon, Regina, Lethbridge, and Red Deer. This outlook follows abnormally dry growing seasons in 2017 and 2018 when hay yields were lower than average. With cattle coming off the pasture early in 2017 and a very poor hay crop in 2018, most producers have used up their reserves, said Sherry Parkinson, president of Manitoba Horse Council. I'm expecting another tough year for getting enough hay and prices to remain high. There was another article I was surfing through before it dicked me around with the prices. It was like $17 for a little bale or something. It was insane. One producer in Saskatchewan admitted he got a bit greedy when pricing his hay this spring. I saw $130 per round bale prices in Regina and Saskatoon, so I upped my prices from $100 to $120, he said. The producer said he also took land prices and equipment prices into consideration before making his decision. I asked myself, what would I want to pay that? You hate to gouge people, and yet it has to be worth it. Experts familiar with the hay market anticipate the newly imposed carbon tax in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Ontario will increase the cost of shipping hay, further raising prices. Louise May, an organic farmer south of Winnipeg, said the prolonged dry conditions caused her to rethink her growing strategy. I decided to cut and produce all of my hay in small square bales instead of round bales, she said. It was a lot more labor to get it off the field and into the shed, but I was worried I wouldn't have enough hay, so I wanted us to waste less and economize more. Actually, that's what we're doing right now as well, because we have 10 acres, we have a bunch of straw going up and down, or hay and alfalfa up along our driveway and stuff there, and we are currently also growing the lawn in our yard and cutting that too. Basically, any section that my family and I can find to be able to cut, we're going to be doing small square bales and do as much as we can there. Okay, continuing. Because May also buys hay to supplement her crop, she noticed prices have significantly increased even from friendly sellers. I've heard of small squares going for $10 a bale right now, and that's unheard of. It's usually around $5. Yeah, like, wow. Like I said, that other article was saying it was selling them for like $15 or $18. Like, wow. Talk about a markup. Worries of a prairie-wide hay shortage have circulated since drought conditions began in 2017 and rumors abound of producers waiting to sell in order to jack up prices. Everyone has to pay the price of shortage, said May. As hay producer, I know you don't get too many chances. Chapman anticipated prices will increase by up to 10% in 2019 after 2018 yields were down by 30 to 35%. If prices don't go up, there's nothing to accommodate that loss. I don't begrudge anybody, but it's a telling tale of how our economy is stressed because of that drought. While hay supplies remain tight, it's too soon to tell if a bona fide shortage will occur. Mother Nature is throwing us a curveball here, said Chapman. Hopefully she'll send us a fastball again and things will get back on track. So yeah, that was before all of this rain that we got in July, and now we're having currently some pretty wicked problems when it comes to severe weather. We're talking like wicked hail, unbelievable thunderstorms. The other day, last week Thursday, there was a tornado that almost touched down just north of our house on the reserve. We saw it on the radar, like our internet had shut off while this stupid thing was trying to come down, headed down to the basement. And then we saw on the radar that, yeah, it was starting to spin just north of us. We were right on the corner of that freaking thing. Right before I was coming down, there was a tornado out by Blaine Lake, just a week or so prior to that, maybe 2 weeks prior to that, there was like tornadoes down by like Danielson, Davidson, like Rosetown, Kindersley area. And I had a friend down there and thank God she made it, but she lost a whole, they were camping down there and like they lost, I'm not even going to go into that. It was not good. It was not good for them. At all. This weather has been insane. I just saw an article yesterday. Hold on, let me see if I can pull it up. I'll see if I can find it. The weather in Alberta has been absolutely nuts, too. Like, we're talking like, where is that article here now? Regina Moose Jaw. Nope, that's strong chance it's a few thunderstorms. Here we go. Let's pull this up. So this was written on July 24th, 2019, 9:30 a.m. There will likely be lots of tired people across Alberta on Wednesday after an intense light show fired up before dawn. Strong thunderstorms roared through parts of Alberta late Tuesday afternoon and evening, prompting Environment Canada to issue a swath of severe thunderstorm watches and warnings as large storm cells swept east from the foothills, bringing heavy downpours and toonie-sized hail. There's a bunch of pictures. The risk for strong storms continued right through overnight and into early morning hours on Wednesday as well, when Twitter erupted with posts on the absolutely crazy lightning show, including the city of Calgary. Being rudely awakened by lightning and thunder in Calgary this morning, the weather network's Kyle Britain tweeted, between the late evening hours on Tuesday and around 7 a.m. on Wednesday morning, more than 12,000 lightning strikes had been detected on radar, with roughly 4,000 of those strikes in southern Alberta alone. No alarm clock needed here. Wow. And that was from the Weather Network. The article is called Intense Lightning Storm Wakes Up Alberta, 12,000 Plus Strikes Detected. And they've got pictures and stuff from Twitter on there as well, some video, and it's insane, guys. Like, wow. Wow. Unbelievable how crazy that weather has been. Absolutely insane. Okay, we're going to take a short commercial break, and we will be right back, folks.
Did you know that every time you swipe your debit card, those behind-the-scenes transaction fees make the big banks even richer? In 2016 alone, these fees added up to $60 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B. Well, what if there was a way to have the convenience of a debit card, but reroute those fees from the banksters to organizations actually doing good in the world? Organizations that protect the environment or feed hungry children? What if your swipes could literally change the world? Well, Groundswell SPC has found a way to do just that. We've designed a Visa debit card program that shares transaction fees with your favorite cause. Groundswell partners with nonprofit organizations that promote the card to their supporters. Their supporters then use the card to power the mission of the nonprofit. It's a win-win-win for everyone, except the big banks, of course. Groundswell is about to launch its first cards into market, and we're inviting you to be part of this movement as an investor in the company. Go to wefunder.com/groundswellcard to learn more. Set up a free WeFunder account and invest in Groundswell today and get your money on mission.
Tune in every Monday with your host, Heather Biederman, for the Liberty Librarian. Liberty Librarian, your home for intellectual freedom news and commentary. Every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. All intellectual freedom fighters are always welcome at our home on Freedomizer Radio. Join us.
Hello everyone, I'd like to talk to you about our newest sponsor, Misty's Gardens.com. Now this is a contraption where you can grow food in your apartment, in a small patio, or if you're like me and you absolutely suck at gardening, this makes life a lot easier. It is a vertical tower garden. We can grow over 20 things at once in a small, compacted area. Good health starts with good habits, like eating wholesome foods. And with Tower Gardens, you can easily grow your own fresh, nutrient-rich food virtually anywhere year-round without soil. So, Misty'sGardens.com, have a look at it, check it out, buy it, plant, and like it. Misty'sGardens.com.
Imagine standing barefoot on cushy grass while you use a professional-grade knife to deftly chop fresh vegetables on your organic bamboo cutting board. The team at MyZestiness.com wants to help your family enjoy home cooking like this more often. They do this by offering fun and functional tools that make your time in the kitchen more efficient and enjoyable. MyZestiness.com offers the finest and most interesting kitchen goods and accessories, all backed by their world-class customer service team. Check out their ever-expanding inventory today. Visit MyZestiness.com. That's zesty like spicy, nest like home. MyZestiness.com.
Journey into Freedom is a show about just that. Come join me as we discuss alternative medicine, energy work, homeschooling, homesteading, barefooting, grounding, and so much more. This is a program where I want people to be heard and to share thoughts and ideas and opinions on everyday freedoms. Learning to free yourself from all things no longer serving to your purpose is the first step to living free. So let's discuss what makes us free and how we can attain those freedoms every day by the way we choose to live. Journey into Freedom with me, your host, Red Gypsy. Hope to see you then. Namaste.
Hello, everybody. This is Sam, host of Against Green. We're back today on the 24th of July. Oh, the fair's coming up this weekend. Fun stuff. So we spent a little bit talking about gardening. Just kind of some mistakes that I've made and fun stuff going on there. It's been a very interesting year so far with trying a bunch of new things and failing at some things and winning at some things. I'm going to take a few minutes, though, this section to read Non-Dare Call It Conspiracy, Chapter 3. I've put the link up for you guys. It should be there. You should be able to download it. I downloaded it to my phone because the link that I used to use is no longer available. So, chapter 3, this book was written by Gary Allen. He used to be one of those political members down in the United States, quit, and he wrote a book. It's from 2012, so it's fairly recent, and it's been an incredibly eye-opening book so far. I'm on chapter 4. I think it's only like 100 pages or something, so normally I would be done by now, but with it being summertime and all the things that are going on right now, I'm kind of reading this book whenever I have a few minutes to spare, so to speak. So I read chapter 3 last night, and it kind of blew. I mean, this whole book has been blowing my mind so far, not going to lie. I mean, it's one of those books where I'm sitting there reading along, I'm like, oh yeah, I knew that, yep, okay, that knew that. You know, more people need to read this book. In fact, I might even make it a requirement that even if you don't agree with it, you have to read this book to be my friend, and you got to watch Mark Passio's Natural Law Seminar to be my friend. So if anybody of my friends are listening to this right now, you're on the hook. I'm making you on the hook. It's 100 pages. If I can make time to read this, even though all the things that I have going on makes my life absolutely frackin'-lutely insane, you've got time to read this. Trust me. All right. So now chapter 3, The Money Manipulators. Many college history professors tell their charges that the books they will be using in class are objective, but stop and ask yourself, is that possible to write a history book without a particular point of view? There are billions of events which take place in the world each day. To think of writing a complete history of a nation covering even a year is absolutely incredible. Not only in a historian's ability to write an objective history limited by the sheer volume of happenings, but by the fact that many of the most important happenings never appear in the papers or even in someone's memoirs. The decisions made by the big boys in the smoke-filled rooms are not reported even in the New York Times, which ostensibly reports all of the news that is to fit to print. All of the news that fits is more accurate description. In order to build his case, a historian must select a minuscule number of facts from the limited number that are known if he does not have a theory. How does he separate important facts from unimportant ones? As Professor Student Crane has pointed out, this is why every book proves the author's thesis. But no book is objective. No book can be objective, and this book is not objective. Liberal reviewers should have a ball quoting that out of context. The information in it is true, but the book is not objective. We have carefully selected the facts to prove our case. We believe that most other historians have focused on the landscape and ignored that which is most important, the cart, the boy, and the donkey. Most of the facts which we bring out are readily verifiable at any large library, but our contention is that we have arranged these facts in order which most accurately reveals their true significance in history. These are the facts that the establishment does not want you to know. Have you ever had the experience of walking into a mystery movie two-thirds of the way through? Confusing, wasn't it? All the evidence made it look as if the butler were the murderer, but in the final scenes you find out, surprisingly, that it was the man's wife all along. You have to stay and see the beginning of the film. Then as all the pieces fall into place, the story makes sense. This situation is very similar to the one in which millions of Americans find themselves today. They are confused by current happenings in the nation. They have come in as the movie, so to speak, is going into its conclusion. The earlier portion of the mystery is needed to make the whole thing understandable. Actually, we are not really starting at the beginning, but we are going back far enough to give meaning to today's happenings. In order to understand the conspiracy, it is necessary to have some rudimentary knowledge of banking and particularly of international bankers. While it would be an oversimplification to ascribe the entire conspiracy to international bankers, they nevertheless have played a key role. Think of the conspiracy as a hand with one finger labeled international banking, others foundations and anti-religion movement, Fabian socialism, and communism. But it was the international bankers of whom Professor Quigley was speaking about when we quoted him earlier as stating that their aim was nothing less than control the world through finance. Where do governments get the enormous amount of money they need? Most, of course, comes from taxation, but governments often spend more than they are willing to tax from their citizens and are forced to borrow. Our national debt is now $455 billion on every cent it's borrowed at interest from somewhere. The public has led to believe that our government borrows from the people through savings bonds. Actually, the smallest percentage of the national debt is held by individuals in this form. Most government bonds, except those owned by the government itself through its trust funds, are held by vast banking firms known as international banks. For centuries, there has been big money to be made by international bankers in the financing of government and kings. Such operators are faced, however, with certain thorny problems. We know that smaller banking operations protect themselves by taking collateral, but what kind of collateral can you get from a government or king? What if the banker comes to collect and the king says off with his head? The process through which one collects a debt from the government or a monarch is not a subject taught in the business schools or for universities, and most of us have never been in the business of financing kings, have not given the problem much thought. But there is a king financing business, and to those who ensure collections, it is a lucrative indeed. Economics professor Stuart Crane notes that there are two means used to collateralize loans to governments and kings. Whenever a business firm borrows big money, its creditor obtains a voice in management to protect its investment. Like a business, no government can borrow big money unless willing to surrender to the creditor some measure of sovereignty as collateral. Certainly, international bankers who have loaned hundreds of billions of dollars to governments around the world command considerable influence in the policies of such governments. But the ultimate advantage the creditor has over the king or president is that if the ruler gets out of line, the banker can finance his enemy or rival. Therefore, if you want to stay in the lucrative king financing business, it is wise to have an enemy or rival waiting in the wings to unseat every king or president to whom you lend. If the king doesn't have an enemy, you must create one. Preeminent in the playing of this game was the famous House of Rothschild. Its founder, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, from 1743 to 1812 of Frankfurt, Germany, kept one of his five sons at home to run the Frankfurt Bank and sent the others to London, Paris, Vienna, and Naples. The Rothschilds became incredibly wealthy during the 19th century by financing governments to fight each other, according to Professor Stuart Crane. If you look back at every war in Europe during the 19th century, you will see that they always ended with the establishment of a balance of power. With every reshuffling, there was a balance of power in a new grouping around the House of Rothschild in England, France, or Austria. They grouped nations so that if any king got out of line, a war would break out, and the war would be decided by which way the financing went. Research researching the debt positions of the warring nations will usually indicate who was to be punished. In describing the characteristics of the Rothschilds and other major international bankers, Dr. Quigley tells us that they remained different from ordinary bankers in several ways. They were cosmopolitan and international. They were close to government and were governments, and they were particularly concerned with government debts, including foreign government debts. These bankers came to be called the international bankers. From Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, page 52. One major reason for this historical blackout on the role of the international bankers in the political history is that the Rothschilds were Jewish. Anti-Semites have played into the hands of the conspiracy by trying to portray the entire conspiracy as Jewish. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The traditionally Anglo-Saxon J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller international banking institutions have played a key role into this conspiracy. But there is no denying the importance of the Rothschilds and their satellites. However, it is just as unreasonable and immoral to blame all Jews for the crimes of the Rothschilds as it is to hold all Baptists accountable for the crimes of the Rockefellers. The Jewish members of the conspiracy have used an organization called the Anti-Defamation League and as an instrument to try and convince everyone that any mention of Rothschilds or their allies is an attack on all Jews. In this way, they have stifled almost all honest scholarship on international bankers and made the subject taboo within universities. Any individual or book exploring this subject is immediately attacked by hundreds of ADL communities all over the country. The ADL has never let truth or logic interfere with its highly professional smear jobs. When no evidence is apparent, the ADL, which staunchly opposed the so-called McCarthyism, accuses people of being latent anti-Semites. Can you imagine how they would yell and scream if someone accused them of being latent communists? Actually, no one has a right to be more angry at the Rothschild clique than their fellow Jews. The Warburgs, part of the Rothschild Empire, helped finance Adolf Hitler. There were few, if any, Rothschilds or Warburgs in the Nazi prison camps. They sat out the war in luxurious hotels in Paris or emigrated to the United States or England. As a group, Jews have suffered most at the hands of these power seekers. A Rothschild has much more in common with a Rockefeller than he does with a tailor from Budapest or the Bronx. Since the keystone of the international banking empires have been government bonds, it has been in the interest of these international bankers to encourage government debt. The higher the debt, the more the interest. Nothing drives government deeply into debt like a war. It has not been an uncommon practice among international bankers to finance both sides of the bloodiest military conflicts. For example, during the Civil War, the North was financed by the Rothschilds through their American agent, August Belmont, and the American South through the Ellingers, there we go, Rothschild relatives. But when wars and revolutions have been useful to international bankers in gaining or increasing control over government, the key to such control has always been control of money. You can control a government if you have it in your debt. A creditor is in a position to demand that the privileges of monopoly from the sovereign. Money-seeking governments have granted monopolies in state banking, natural resources, oil concessions, and transportation. However, the monopoly which the international financiers most covet is control over a nation's money. Eventually, these international bankers actually owned a private corporations, the central banks from the various European nations. The Bank of England, the Bank of France, and Bank of Germany were not owned by their respective governments, almost everyone imagines, but were privately owned monopolies granted by the head of state, usually in return for loans. Under the system observed by Reginald McKenna, president of the Midlands Bank of England, those that create the issue, the money, and the credit direct the policies of government and hold in their hands the destiny of the people. Once the government is indebted to the bankers, it is at their mercy. A frightening example was cited by the London Financial Times on September 26, 1921, which revealed that even at the time, half a dozen men at the top of big five banks could upset the whole fabric of government finance by refraining from renewing treasury bills. All those who have sought dictatorial control over modern nations have understood the necessity of a central bank. When the League of Just Men hired a hack revolutionary named Karl Marx to write a blueprint for the conquest we called the Communist Manifesto, the fifth plank read, centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Lenin later said that the establishment of a central bank was 90% of communizing a country. Such conspirators knew that you cannot take control of a nation without military force unless the nation has a central bank through which you can control its economy. The anarchist Bakunin sarcastically remarked about the followers of Karl Marx, "They have one foot in the bank and the other foot in the socialist movement." The international financiers set up their own front man in charge of each of Europe's central banks, Professor Quigley reports. It must not be felt that these heads of the world's chief central banks were themselves substantive powers in world finance. They were not. Rather, they were the technicians and agents of the dominant investment bankers of their own countries who have raised them up and were perfectly capable of throwing them down. The substantive financial powers of the world were in the hands of these investment bankers, also called international or merchant bankers, who renamed largely behind the scenes in their own unincorporated private banks. These formed a system of international cooperation and national dominance which was more private, more powerful, and more secret than that of the agents in the central banks. Quigley, O.P., cites pages 326 to 327. Dr. Quigley also reveals that the international bankers who owned and controlled the banks of England and France maintained their power even after those banks were theoretically socialized. Naturally, those who controlled the central banks of Europe were eager from the start to fasten a similar establishment on the United States. From the earliest days, the founding fathers had been conscious of attempts to control America through money manipulation. They had carried on a running battle with the international bankers. Thomas Jefferson wrote to John Adams, I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. But even though America did not have a central bank after President Jackson abolished it in 1836, the European financiers and their American agents managed to obtain a great deal of control over the monetary system. Gustavus Myers, in The History of the Great American Fortunes, reveals, under the surface, the Rothschilds long had a powerful influence in dictating American financial laws. The law record shows that they were in power in the old Bank of the United States, abolished by Andrew Jackson. During the 19th century, the leading financiers of the metropolitan East often cut one another's financial throats. But as their Western and rural victims started to organize, I'll zoom in here, just give me a second. Politically, the robber barons saw that they had a community of interest towards which they must work together to protect themselves from thousands of irate farmers and up-and-coming competitors. This diffusion of economic power was one of the main factors stimulating the demands for a central bank by would-be business and financial monopolists. In Years of Plunder, Protector Hansel writes of this area, among the Morgans, Kuhn Loebs, and other similar pillars in the industrial order, there was a less disposition to become involved in disagreements that led to financial dislocation. A community of interest came into being with results that they were highly, highly beneficial. But aside from the major Eastern centers, most American bankers and their customers still distrusted the whole concept. In order to show the hinterlands that they were going to need a central banking system, the international bankers created a series of panics as a demonstration of their powers, a warning of what could happen unless the rest of the bankers got in line. The man in charge of conducting these lessons were J. Painter Pierpont Morgan. Fuck, this guy just sounds like a loser. American-born but educated in English and Germany. England and Germany. Morgan is referred to by many, including Congressman Lewis McFadden, a banker who for 10 years headed to the House of Banking and Currency Committee as the top American agent of English Rothschilds. By the turn of the century, J.P. Morgan was already an old hand at creating artificial panics. Such affairs were well coordinated. Senior Rob Owen, a co-author of the Federal Reserve Act. You guys are going to have to forgive me. I've got a little bit. I swear I have dyslexia a little bit. I like to read things backwards or make up words in my head. You guys probably noticed that. Anyway, continuing. Who later deeply regretted his role, testified before a congressional committee that the bank he owned received from the National Bankers Association what came to be known as the Panic Circular of 1983. It stated, "You will at once retire 1/3 of your circulation and call in 1/2 of your loans." Historian Frederick Lewis Allen tells in Life magazine in April 25, 1949, of Morgan's role in spreading rumors about insolvency of the Knickerbocker Bank and the Trust Company of America, which rumors triggered in the 1907 panic. In answer to the question, did Morgan precipitate the panic, Allen reports, Oakley Thorne, the president of the particular trust company, testified later before a congressional committee that his bank had been subjected to only moderate withdrawals, that he had not applied for help, and that it was the Morgan sore point statement alone that had caused the run on his bank. From this testimony, plus the disciplinary measures taken by the clearinghouse against the Hines, Morse, and Thomas banks, plus other fragments of supposedly pertinent evidence, certain chroniclers have arrived at the ingenious conclusion that the Morgan interests took advantage of the unsettled conditions during autumn of 1907 to precipitate the panic, guiding it shrewdly as it progressed so that it would kill off rival banks and consolidate the preeminence of the banks within the Morgan orbit. Zooming in again. The panic which Morgan had created had proceeded to end almost single-handedly. He had made his point, Frederick Allen explains. The lesson of the panic of 1907 was clear, though not for some 6 years, it was destined to be embodied in legislation. The United States gravely needed a central banking system. The man who was to play the most significant part in providing America with that central bank was Paul Warburg, who, along with his brother Felix, had immigrated to the United States from Germany in 1902. They left brother Max, later a major financier of the Russian Revolution, at home in Frankfurt to run the family bank M.N. Warburg & Company. Paul Warburg married Nina Loeb, daughter of Solomon Loeb of Kuhn, Loeb and Company, America's most powerful international banking firm. Brother Felix married Frieda Schiff, daughter of Jacob Schiff, the ruling power behind Kuhn, Loeb. Stephen Birmingham writes in his authoritative Our Crowd, "In the 18th century, the Schiff and Rothschilds shared a double house. In Frankfurt, Schiff reportedly bought his partnership in Kuhn Loeb with Rothschild money. Both Paul and Felix Warburg became partners in Kuhn Loeb & Company. In 1907, the year of the Morgan precipitated panic, Paul Warburg began spending almost all of his time writing and lecturing on the need for bank reform. Kuhn, Loeb and Company was sufficiently public-spirited about the matter to keep him on salary at $500,000 per year. For the next 6 years, he donated his time to the public good. Working with Warburg in promoting this banking reform was Nelson Aldrich, known as Morgan's floor broker in the Senate. Aldrich's daughter, Abby, married John D. Rockefeller. The current governor of New York is named for his maternal grandfather. And then it's on to chapter 4. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back, folks.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative, weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Things seem to be going wrong in the world today. Every aspect of our lives seems to be under attack sometimes. Many struggle to make sense out of it. What is really going on? Identifying the problem is critical to any solution. Many people claim to have answers. But what is the truth? What works? What has worked in the past? History does repeat itself, and you must learn from it. You have choices. We cannot change the course of history, but we may change our role in it. All roads lead to Rome. All roads lead to the kingdom of God. The question is, which way are you going? Join us to make sense out of it all in the Sabbath hour at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time or 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for an iconoclastic look at the world yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and hear about the keys of the kingdom.
It has never been more clear that we, the people, must unite to preserve our freedom. All over the country, we are seeing similar fights against the systematic attempt to remove our medical choice and medical freedoms. So I welcome you to listen in to the Tell You Like It Is show on freedomizerradio.com. It's all about informed consent, being properly informed, and then making those decisions for your family and how you see fit. So join me, your host, Talia, live on Wednesdays and Thursdays every week on freedomizerradio.com. From 10:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific.
Oh, hello everybody. This is Sam, host of Against the Grain. And I forgot to tell you about that. A whole bunch of exciting news is happening over at Freedomizer Radio right now. We've got a whole bunch of new shows popping up. We got more shows on the way. If you want a radio show, hit us up on Freedomizer Radio. We've got lots of slots available. We also have a big thing going on. We've got a whole revamp going on with our website and a whole bunch of new stuff coming out. So make sure you guys stay tuned with Freedomizer Radio here for our big announcements coming in the future. It's going to be great. It's going to be amazing. Again, if you want a radio show, talk to us. Be part of our team. It's a wonderful thing. We have a wonderful team, good people. Everybody works together really well. It's absolutely great. So before the commercial break, if you're popping in just now, we were just reading Chapter 3 from None Dare Call It Conspiracy. This book is essentially talking about how they're using socialism to really take over absolutely everything. I think this is chapter 5. They've got like the Bolshevik Revolution and a whole bunch of other stuff in here. Chapter 5, establishing the establishment, world supra government. It's we're taking things next level, slowly and ever so, well, it's not even slow anymore. If you have your eyes open at all, you can see the agenda absolutely everywhere. how they're taking over absolutely everything one step at a time. And I know there's people out there that say, well, you know, the socialism, the definition of socialism or any of that, the socialism that they have going on now isn't the actual socialism that, you know, was meant to be with, you know, traditional people or anything like that. I've heard that quite a few times from quite a few different people. But that's not relevant here. What is relevant here is the definition of socialism to which the government is bringing in complete domination and entirely, like, overwhelming mind control, complete control over the resources, absolutely everything. You can see it happening quite prominently in Canada right now, or, you know, in Britain, Europe, any of those kinds of places. People like to fantasize and say how amazing socialism is, but really it's not that amazing. It's actually really, really bad. Really bad. And you're going to have a hard time trying to convince me otherwise. Because, like, even if you sit there and you say, well, you know, I can live on it and blah, 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 it's like, but it completely destroys the individual. It completely destroys individualism. It destroys properties, the rights of property. It destroys absolutely everything. And, I mean, that's one of the things that I ask everybody that's like, oh, socialism, it's so great. It's like, yeah, but, like, what if the government decided that you aren't worthy anymore of living? What are you going to do? And they're like, oh, they wouldn't do that, but they are. They are right now when it comes to things like vaccines. And I really don't care whether you think vaccines save lives or whether or not you think they are the epitome of all things bad. That, again, is not relevant here. What is relevant is the fact that they are taking away your right of choice by regulating all healthcare professionals, and they are forcing you to have your vaccines in order to be able to go to school. They're even allowing, down in Oregon in the United States, they're allowing doctors to start handing out vaccines for things like HPV for oral cancer. If a chiro, okay, just for frame of reference here, chiropractors here anyway damn near have the same education as a doctor. There's a few classes that they take that's different, obviously. I mean, one deals with bones and stuff, and the other one doesn't have an idea when it comes to bones, which is actually funny, because if they have the same education for the most part, and if you talk to a doctor or you talk to a chiropractor, they basically have the same education minus some specialties. But doctors don't seem to know a whole lot about chiropractic care and any of that kind of stuff. But still, chiropractors are not allowed to discuss vaccines under the license in Canada because that is outside their area of knowledge, outside their area of expertise. They're not qualified to be discussing vaccines. So if they do, especially publicly, I've heard of quite a few chiros around Canada here that they are not allowed to discuss publicly about vaccines and their opinions on them, or they could lose their license. And therefore, they lose their job, they lose their livelihood, they lose everything. Even though, I mean, the news has no problem with discussing whether or not your kid has a vaccine. In fact, they're trying to bring in New Brunswick right now as we speak. They're trying to bring in mandatory vaccines for public schools, even though it's been ruled in court many, many times that they cannot bring in mandatory vaccines due to the religious freedom. And you know what the policymakers are doing? They're doing it anyway. They're pushing for it. They're doing it anyway. So how long is it going to be before they start taking away your right to have a job? You can't work anymore because you're not vaccinated. I mean, first it's your kid and your kids, and then it's going to be being able to have a job, you know, being able to go to work. And if you don't go to work, you have no income. Well, we're going to cut you off your disability because, well, why were you fired? Well, you weren't vaccinated. Well, you better get vaccinated. Then suddenly you have no home. Because the minute they start taxing the land, the very land you live on, they put you into servitude. And you cannot tell me anything otherwise. The minute you are being forced to work for somebody else in order to be able to live, that is servitude. Period. That's slavery. That's slavery, folks. That's exactly what it is. It's slavery. It's not even servitude anymore, because servitude is by option. You have an option to put yourself into servitude, in which case you can end that at any time. That's your right. This is not. This is a step beyond. It is slavery. And you cannot tell me anything otherwise. Because go ahead and try to not pay your land taxes. Go ahead and try to not pay your rent. Go ahead and try and work your job and not be able to pay that part of the income tax. You go ahead and you try that. You try for one day not paying your rent or your mortgage. 1 month and you're going to be out on your butt. And down, you know, or on places like the coast in BC, that might be doable. But in the prairie provinces, I can guarantee you, you try that and you're going to get one hell of a rude awakening how much it sucks to be homeless around here. I mean, summertime you have mosquitoes and blistering heat. Wintertime you've got cold that will kill you. Guaranteed. If you're outside on a night of minus 35, 40, you will die. There is no other option. So you have that fun, magnificent stuff going on there. I was going on a rant. No, I can't remember what rant I was going on. Yes, socialism. So anyway, they're doing it with all these vaccines and stuff where they're forcing you to get vaccinated, and they're taking away that right of choice. And even in Canada, I mean, you have the Styles and Titles Act, which assures, you know, the Queen is the defender of the faith. You have things like, what's it called? Give me a second here. Elimination of all forms. Yep. Of religious intolerance as signed by the UN. That's out there, and yet they're going ahead and they're completely ignoring that kind of stuff going on. I mean, there was people hung for the Nuremberg trials. There was people hung for the Nuremberg. There was people who were put to death over the Nuremberg trials for medical experimentation during World War II on Jews, Polish people, Gypsies, you know, people like that. And they're doing the same thing. And they can go ahead and they can say that, oh, there's studies, but there's never been one with a placebo. And they can make excuses to say, well, we don't need one with a placebo, but if you actually want to know the efficiency and the safety of the vaccine, you have to have a placebo, at least one to start, and they've never had that. They just use other vaccines as the placebo. You can't do that. That's not the way it works in science. I mean, you can wiggle around that, especially if you have, you know, again, if you use a placebo the first time and you compare the two and stuff, it makes things a little easier, but it's cutting corners, which can be very dangerous again in science because, I mean, how many things have we known in history past where, you know, tobacco was safe for smoking? Smoke a cigarette when you're pregnant. Oh, just kidding. That's not a good thing anymore. Turns out that causes a lot of problems. Oh, snap. You know, things like that. It's just, it's a giant medical experiment. And the people who made their way over, who were too valuable to throw away and kill. I mean, you can look up Operation Paperclip. It was real. They're declassified documents. It's on a government website. If you guys are ever interested in it, I strongly suggest you check it out, especially if you're not a conspiracy nut. If you're, you know, a little bit of a statist and tend to think that the government would never do anything like that, they definitely have. They definitely have, and they're doing things like that right now. The only difference right now is that they think you're too stupid to know any different, and they get you to consent through papers. Learn the law of contracts. I strongly suggest people start learning things like contract law, learning the maxims of law, learning things like equity, that kind of stuff, because an empowered people is a knowledgeable people, and things tend to get a little sticky when it comes to a knowledgeable people. But as you can see, as from chapter 3 from this book, you can see that the governments are just doing what the bankers want, because if they don't, we're going to end up in serious trouble because, well, I mean, this is going to be like the Gaddafi thing all over again. How many people, that's actually when I started to wake up, is shortly after that, learning about vaccines, because I was totally on the mainstream side with Gaddafi needed to go. And then a year or two years later, I found out that that was all a lie. And things like the stuff this book is talking about, you know, None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen, strongly recommend you take some time out of your day to read that book. Even if you've got to take some time off Facebook, read that book. Turns out that was all a lie. It kind of makes you wonder how possible is it that we can even get out of a sticky situation like that? Because if the international bankers have the whole world underneath their thumb, I mean, it's going to take a whole global awakening in order to get rid of these buggers. Because just doing it as one country, they're just going to make a war and they're going to take you out. And it's going to be like the Jesuit colonization all over again, except this time it's not just going to be Native peoples, even though they are still continuing to colonialize. And you can't say they're not, because I'll tell you what, a little while ago I found out that once upon a time, if you were indigenous, in order to sign up for a treaty card, that's all you needed was a family line. You just needed some proof of family line, that you were related in order to get a treaty card. But now you need a government-issued birth certificate in order to get your treaty card. And that might not seem like a big deal to most people, because birth certificate, that's how you get your social insurance and all that other crap. But if you actually really sit down and you think about it, birth certificates are issued by the Queen. And in order to be able to get the benefits that everybody allegedly deserves under this system, you need to sign up as the Queen's bitch. And that's a real harsh reality for a lot of people that think it's for benefit, but it really is not. And not only did you just end up signing up and being colonialized right from birth into the system, it's another strike against Native people and their sovereignty. So that's always something fun to think about. I mean, outside the fact that the Indian Act itself is literally only a piece of legislation for controls of the land and the monies of Native people or Indian people, as dictated by the definition of what a colonialist system creates and dictates as what an Indian is, which is really kind of messed up when you actually start looking into it. The land is held in trust. If you look at, the Indian Report, Indian Policy, I think it's either 59 or 69, one of those two. It even says in there that the land is held in trust. So, I mean, Native people are wards of the Crown. You know, First Nations people are wards of the Crown, and the Crown gets to dictate what they do with the property. Because according to them, and to many scholars, surprisingly, I'm kind of surprised about that, to many, many scholars out there, that they're not capable of being able to form their own governments in line and consistency with the government that we have today, which is funny because they never really wanted the government that we had today to begin with. Their governmental systems were working just perfectly fine. They had no issues. Everybody, for the most part, was on the same page. Everybody, for the most part, got along. I mean, there was a few squabbles between tribes here or there. I mean, some tribes just hated other tribes and any of that, but you're going to find that anywhere you go with any group of people that you have. I mean, but overall, for the most part, it was a pretty peaceful thing going on. And, you know, the Queen just came in and messed that all up because that's what these people do. And then you have the Rothschilds that come in and, you know, mess that all up. So that's been absolutely interesting stuff and quite eye-opening to see how true this book really is and how true this stuff really is when it comes to, you know, food and stuff going on. And that's going to be what's really scary is when you have these weather extremisms like the grand solar minimum going on where it's getting really, really cold and it's going to get really cold fast. And it's basically going to be like a mini ice age and we're not going to be able to grow the kind of food that we have on a large scale like we have anymore. People are going to start getting hungry. These urban centers where most of the people in urban centers can't do anything except for push a pin and wipe their ass. I know that sounds really mean, you guys, and I'm so sorry for the way it's sounding, but it's the truth. Most people do not have any sort of survival skills to save their own skin. Most people do not know how to live out anywhere, to do anything, and most people are not capable of doing so, which is really, really sad because when shit hits the fan, a lot of these people are going to essentially end up either turning to the system because that's the only thing they have, because that's the only way the system has been set up. They're taxing the people right out of the country to start moving to the city because it's too expensive to live out in the country and it's too problematic to live out in the country. I mean, how are you supposed to raise kids living on the country when you don't have a job? Or if you do have a job, your fields, you know, your crop is completely destroyed this year and you've still got a mortgage to pay, you've still got taxes to pay, you've still got all this stuff to pay. And you now have no income in order to be able to do it because everything was completely wiped out. You're screwed. You have to sell it all or let the bank take it. The international bankers, you have to let them take it and you have to go somewhere else where there's jobs, generally in the city, where there's, you know, jobs everywhere. And it's frustrating because they're doing this and they're using the finances, they're using the food to control everybody, and it's just slipping right under everybody's noses. Nobody is even none the wiser except for complaining that the groceries are so expensive and bills are so expensive and all this stuff is so expensive. And nobody seems to know why. So I strongly encourage all of you, again, I'm not going to shut up about this book. You need to read it. I have a link in the show description. Start learning how to garden. Start learning how to, you know, do things like own an animal, raise livestock, go hunting. Start learning how to completely live off the land. Because that's what's going to save you. It ain't going to be the government. Because that's what they want. They want you to completely rely on them so that when shit completely hits the fan, because it's gonna, one way or another, either the weather is gonna take us all out or it's a creation of both the weather with the grand solar minimum and the socialist system that they set up for everybody through mind control and complete takeover of the resources. Complete takeover. First things were private, then they went public. Now they went private again. However, it's private only by the big corporations. It's not so much the small businesses and stuff anymore because they don't really care for the small businesses. As long as you're working for the big businesses, it is the way it is. So Garden of Vegan documentary is there. Definitely encourage you guys to check out their site, check out their stuff. Get growing. Even if it's, again, like I said at the beginning of the show, even if it's a tomato plant in a potted planter just to start there this year while you're in an apartment, then you move on to, you know, 5 plants in the window next year. And then next thing you know, you've got a whole hydroponic system going on in the one half of your apartment with grow lights and all the fun stuff. And then you take it to the next step. You go out, you move out into a house or something. And then you start backyard gardening, front yard gardening, starting learning how to do this. Or hell, you even move out to an acreage. Or you take that next step and you move out to a commune with a bunch of other people and you work together, you know, to kind of get together and, like, do your own thing, you know, anything like that, like a small village or something. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a commune. Like, it can just be anything, a small village of people where you all grow your big-ass gardens and you all just share food and stuff. You know, things like the way they used to be. You know, or you go nomadic and you start living off the land entirely, although, again, that's starting to become a little problematic with some areas either being poisoned or being completely taken over by government. But really, it ain't no different. We're all being poisoned anyway, so it's just what we can do to get by, to do the best that we can with our health while we're still here and still serving our purpose to help other people and to move to the next step and all that fun stuff. So, it's good. Got to start somewhere. It's not all doom and gloom. It's absolutely not all doom and gloom. Definitely don't give up. This whole year has taught me so much about not giving up. From my garden just kind of being strange to, oh yeah, my dog died last week. I want to apologize. This last week has been crazy. She decided it was time to go. So that was fun. Both my cattle were sick this last week, and we managed to mostly fix up both of them. With one still got some issues, so we're working on him. But yeah, to my chickens, I had 30 eggs in the incubator, and they were all about to hatch, and then the incubator messed up from a power surge, we're pretty sure, and fried my eggs. The temperature went too high. Fried my poor eggs. I did manage to hatch a bunch, but it was still quite sad that a bunch of them didn't work out. To the garden, you know, neglecting putting nitrogen in and thinking that wasn't going to be a big deal. So my garden is not going to be quite as good as I wanted it to be this year, but it's definitely going to be okay next year, hoping, crossing fingers. So it's all been a lot of learning experiences and absolutely not giving up. Definitely don't give up. There's going to be some bumps along the way, but it's all patience is key, learning is key, and take everything as a gift, whether it's, you know, a good thing happening or a bad thing, the gift is learning from it. It's been an incredible year so far. So next week, I've got a recording for you guys with Dan the Bard. You can check his stuff out. I'll go here really quick. There we go. www.paganmusic.co.uk. We've got a pre-recording for you guys coming out next week with that fun stuff. We're trying to get Jordan Maxwell on here again. We're going to get a pre-recording with Michael Obernicia here to play very soon for you guys. So we got a whole bunch of fun stuff coming up this next little while. Crazy, crazy stuff. Summer is half done, and things have just been nuts. But it's so good. Everything is so good. It's just great. Okay, guys, I will see you guys again next week. Well, kind of, sort of. I'll be here, but I'll be playing a pre-recording for you guys. Bye. Catch you guys later. Happy Wednesday. Bye-bye.